play this evening?
Fine.
Having anything to talk to you about tonight?
No.
I asked Barrett, and I said, what should I talk to you about? He says, huh? Ask all sorts of people, they wouldn't talk. So I got stuck with it, and that means you're stuck. So just same old thing. Same old thing, same old philosophy, one kind or another. But truth of the matter is, maybe I've never talked about what we're trying to do. You know, we all know what we're trying to do, so I've never talked about what we're trying to do. And maybe that would be a good thing to talk about. Maybe you think you know what we're doing. Maybe I think you know. And maybe I think I know. And maybe you think I know. The truth of the matter is, the subject of Scientology is the subject of knowingness. That is the subject, knowingness. And if you think that knowingness imputes a datum to know, then you've never been run all the way on the chart of attitudes on rising scale processing. The truth of the matter is, in order to know, you have to have first the potentiality of knowing, and second, the potentiality of knowing. And then third, the potentiality of inventing something to know. And then fourth, the ability to agree with somebody else that we'll know this now. Got that now? It's very simple. Let's take a little grain of sand. You see it? I see it? Well, don't you? Anyway, you take that little grain of sand. There it is. What is it? It's your consideration that there's a grain of sand, and my consideration that there's a grain of sand, agreed upon that there's a grain of sand. So there is a grain of sand. If you don't believe this is true, get yourself some processing sometime in the definite direction of how real that wall is. And after you run this for a short time, if your bed is in condition that you can be run on the process, after you run it for a short time, you're liable to discover a hole in the wall as far as you're concerned. We had a fellow, very, very nice fellow, been dying eggs for a long time. He's one of the old-timers. Real nice guy. And he was sitting down on some new processes the other day. And he wasn't running, it is real, it isn't real. He was simply sitting there and he was looking at the wall. And all of a sudden he was looking right on through the wall with his physical body's eyes. And this didn't surprise him because he already knew my definition for this, so he knew the wall would come back, and it did. The point is that knowingness, in an educational sense, implies that there is a datum to be known. You say, I'm a real savvy fellow. I know arithmetic, geography, literature, monotony. I know these terrific subjects from beginning to end, and therefore I am a very wise fellow. Then somebody comes along and says, if you don't stop sitting in the middle of the street, the car going by is going to run over you. And he says, I know. Crunch. His concentration of knowingness is what he might call the abstract. He knows a great many abstracts and no practicalities. In other words, he's gone to a point where he has exceeded, forgotten, buried, and put aside all the considerations he had when he was a child, and he is looking at a lot of invented material out of a textbook somewhere, and he gets fixated on this, and he thinks that's knowingness. Well, fortunately for thee and me, there are a great many agreements which we could know. And knowing those agreements, we have reality. And if you think we've got any other reality than that, it's an interesting thing to see what would happen if you started to memorize the 51 axioms of Scientology. Comlag, 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 comlag. Why would these particular axioms install in the individual such a hesitancy to retain them in his memory? Is because they are in his memory so solidly that they are completely forgotten, and every time they're just considerations. He and the rest of the boys have been making these all the way down the track. Every time, everywhere he has been alive, he is confronted with these considerations. And he's gotten them, and he's submerged them, and they are in a state of active forgottenness. Got the idea? So he comes along and he says, let's say one of the axioms is I see a cat, which it isn't. And it says here, axiom 36, I see a cat. And actually just on top of this, this is basically an agreement, and then right on top of it is a tremendous forgettingness. It's real cute making somebody memorize the axioms. If he did a real good job on it, it'd practically clear him. Because he'd have to wipe out of existence all these forgetters which are lying on top of the axioms. So he says, I see a cat, forgetter. All right. So now axiom 30... What number was that? Well, anyway, the axiom is... What was I doing? You get the idea. Now he looks at it again. It says, axiom 36, I see a cat. And he looks at it again, and he says, now I'll be able to remember that. And he puts down the book, and he says, axiom 36. What happened to it? Well, every time he makes a pass at it, a little bit more of the forgettingness, which is an agreement too. We're going to make these things up, and then we're going to forget about them, and that's part of the agreement. So that part of the agreement starts to rub off of axiom 36. He's had it in his consciousness for a long while. It's been buried below the surface of life for a long time and is in itself part of the woof and warp of life. And if he keeps making a pass at it, using about 10 or 12 times the time necessary to memorize the Declaration of Independence backwards, he would probably be clear. Because after he gets the forgetter rubbed out, if he went on studying it, not just to remember it, but he went on studying it, the next part of the sandwich is agreed upon. See? Agreement. And he began to wonder how he was so dopey as to agree upon I see a cat. Seems to be a strange thing to agree upon. As a matter of fact, axiom 36 might as well be I see a horse, I see a cow. It might be almost anything. I run away from cows. That might be axiom 36. Well, he could all by himself make up his mind then that he would no longer believe and have faith, trust in this agreement he himself has subscribed to and entered in upon, contract 36 of this universe. No longer going to subscribe to this contract. What's he going to do with it? He's just going to change his mind. Going to change his mind, and he's going to make up a new axiom. Well, that's very fine, and he could have this as a new axiom, and undoubtedly his universe could now have five dimensions, but unless somebody has agreed with him, he's living in that universe all by himself. See how these axioms grow? Fellow gets an idea, somebody else agrees with the idea, other people agree with the idea, other people agree with the idea, other people agree with the idea, and it gets solid. It takes form. It takes physical size. It takes position in space. It takes a mobility. It begins to possess itself of a certain energy. Got that? Those things upon which we agree have become the physical universe. Now, this is no Christian scientist talking. I have bailed out too many people from insane asylums who began to study Christianity at an early age, or even an advanced age. It's really no knock against Christianity. Christianity is all illusion, so you can't knock it. There's nothing there. Now, don't get on the idea that we're talking about the all is illusion of Christian Science. We are not, very definitely not talking about this at all. We're not saying all is illusion. We're saying it's real, it's real, it's real. But we're saying why it's real is because you agree and I agree that it's real. And that makes it real. I have somebody come along once in a while, and he says, well, actually, I understand the psychosomatic illnesses include arthritis, and this actually is caused by, you know, somebody getting the idea that he's sick, and he gets sick, you know? And all it is, he's got something wrong with his head, you know? He just thinks he's sick, so therefore he thinks he's sick, and all he's got to do is say, I don't know, he's not got arthritis anymore. Well, unfortunately, no auditor who was ever audited in arthritic would make such a remark. Because it won't come true. We say, it's a psychosomatic illness, and this fellow's made up his mind that he has an illness, and therefore it's all in his head, so it isn't a real illness. Now, you get how stupidly circumlocutive that logic is? Beautiful word, circumlocutive. Put it in the dictionary sometime. See what gorgeous mislogic we have here. You see, it's all in his head. He made the consideration himself that he was sick in some fashion or another. And so, therefore, it's not a real illness. There's really nothing wrong with him, and it doesn't hurt or cripple him. That's just complete mislogic. If Joe Doakes gets the idea that he has arthritis, and this is agreed upon sufficiently, and if he buries adequately enough the datum that he agreed he had arthritis, he conceived he had arthritis, and was sick, and if he buries this deeply enough and forgets it solidly enough, one fine day he starts to close his hand and he goes, creak. He says, what's this? What on earth has happened here? Creak. Now, it's very, very true that that is entirely imaginary in its conception, in its basic agreements. It is a product of the mind, but not when it goes creak. It's real. And the pain that goes along with it's real, and the cripplement that occurs as a result thereof is real, and anything and everything connected with it's real. And if he went to... By the way, I've lately been talking a little too much about... I slam around things like psychology and so forth just for a gag. There aren't many laughs in the world. What's his name? Milton Berle has stolen all of them. And so I just have to have something for a laugh, so I talk about psychology and medicine. But actually, it isn't really serious at all. I mean, I'm not serious about this. We don't have to be serious about it. I have a little announcement I'd like to make now. There was a bill up here in the House, in the legislature, which was going to make it absolutely necessary for a state board to certify whether or not you could practice in the field of the mind. You could only practice in the field of the mind if you had a PhD in psychology. I don't know what this would have to do with it, but this is the way the bill read. If you practice in the field of the mind, the state board which was being composed would say that you had to be a PhD, had to have a degree in an accredited university in psychology. This is something like, by the way, to be better sense to say, because the body runs on electronics, all medical doctors will have to be electronic engineers. That actually makes better sense than if you're going to practice in the field of the mind, you have to have a degree in psychology, because the definition of psychology specifically states in the modern, most modern text there is, that it does not apply to the mind or the spirit anymore. It doesn't say what it does apply to, but it just says it doesn't any longer apply to the mind. That's a fact, by the way. I mean, I could show you the text. The leading text of the country. They are studying something, but they don't know. So this is House Bill 81. And the various organizations connected with Dianetics and Scientology and some other organizations went into immediate, and I might say violently quick action. The second House Bill 81 was proposed, and there were 15 legislators all in favor of it. All of them good degrees in brands, fine degrees in feeding steers. And these fellows were all out. And the newspapers of this town, a very short time ago, were carrying recommendations from the leading educators. They didn't say in what, but the leading educators that this bill go through. But the organizations which did not believe that this should go through jumped immediately to the lanyard and yanked. And we had no more than heard the reverberations of the shell departing than we got a letter from the state legislature, one representative, Terry Ahn, to whom we are indebted, informing us that he had made the motion which killed the bill, deader than a mackerel, and it is now ancient history and cannot be passed. Thank you. The entire field of the mind is much too speculative, much too uncertain, and much too vast to be monopolized by anyone, including me or anybody else. But we just have a better grip on it than other people. Now, we're talking now in the field of reality. Now, here were a number of people who came to a sudden agreement that something is not going to be with us anymore, and it was gone. You got that as an example? Actually, it's almost numerical. The number of people that agree that it's so, make it so. And if there's a minority that says it isn't so, all the minority does is introduce a slight doubt into the minds of the majority. You see that? It becomes no less real, but there's a slight doubt may occur if there's a sufficient minority. And that is the way democracies run. They agree that the majority rules. In other words, the major agreement of the land shall become the reality of the land. It would be very silly to have that on your statute books, because it's on the books of the physical universe. And it was passed a long time before Thomas Jefferson took his quill in hand and wrote several documents of which we have some knowledge. Now, rule by majority is only one of the manifestations of reality. Here, let us take this question of sanity. If three-quarters of us absolutely believed, entirely and completely, that there was a pterodactyl flying in the center of this room, and the other quarter said, no, there was nothing there, I'm afraid that the pterodactyl party would win. I'm just afraid that would occur. So much so that a group of people were standing on a street corner, and a fellow walked up and says, ooh, what horrible black cats. And they looked around and they saw no black cats. The group would turn around to each other and say, crazy. The idea? They all might be stone blind. There might be a black cat there, but they would put into an institution the fellow that saw the black cat. That is the little neat thing behind sanity and insanity. If a person's family agrees entirely that he's a bad boy, that he's no good and will never amount to anything, they agree entirely on this, and he doesn't agree on this, nothing will occur. But if they agree entirely and he agrees too, that's the reality. You got this? It isn't necessary for anyone to agree with anyone unless he wants to. But having agreed, a reality is formed. Now, maybe a more able person than Homo sapiens simply would then say, well, agreement wiped out, and would cease to be a part of that reality. Unfortunately, Homo sapiens has the interesting quality of he got it shortly. It's the same strain that came up with Boston Bull Terriers. They keep hanging on. When a person agrees to something, that's it. You could probably prove to an army general conclusively, overwhelmingly, that the left flank had just been wiped out, but if it didn't read that way in his tactics textbook or something, he'd go on writing the mortars. You know? He doesn't give up hope until the last man is dead. You know, that kind of a stupid persistence, unable to change the mind in view of evidence. That the agreement is now different, General. See? And he says, no, the old agreement. Now, I'll give you an idea. Almost any military body is very persistent in this line. In 1896 or thereabouts, long after the Battle of the Monitor and Merrimack, when every fleet in the world had turned to steel, hulls, iron, when the U.S. itself was working up toward a supremacy in iron ships, the United States Congress was asked to pass a bill appropriating a vast sum of money for the construction of a first-line man-of-war, square-rigged with a wooden hull, in 1896. Curious, isn't it? Why would they be doing this? The last appropriation for that sort of thing, by any logic, would have been maybe 1863 or 64 in the hysteria of the Civil War. Somebody might not have gotten the word about the Monitor and Merrimack, you know? They might have passed it then, but certainly no later than that. And yet in 1896, they passed a law, actually did this, really. They did appropriate the funds for the construction of a full-rigged wooden man-of-war for use by the U.S. Navy. Nobody ever built it. Now, that's an oddity, isn't it? Have you ever noticed that one is always thoroughly equipped to fight the last war? You know that today we are probably wonderfully armed to fight the Korean War. In the Korean War, at its beginning, we were well equipped to fight the, what was the early defeats in World War II, I forget them. I was there, and it just left memory. Anyway, they were fully equipped at the beginning of the Korean War to fight the beginning of World War II, the last war, the war just before that one, you see? And they are busy conscripting now to fight the Korean War. See, they get all geared up. Well, what happens here is you get a persistence of agreement because part of the agreement is to persist. It's always to persist. You see the agreement? To persist. So we make a big agreement and we say this is the way to fight a war. And all the admirals get together and all the generals get together. They never talk to the privates, by the way. I talked to a private once and he said, you know, I was never called into a single staff conference during the entirety of World War II. Astonishing fact. I got his affidavit just because it was so peculiar. Here we have, in every agreement, the forward survival of the agreement itself, don't you see? So we have all these people agreed on how to fight a war. And then we start to fight a war. But it's not the same war we agreed upon that we were going to fight. It's the next war. So they look around and they take their General Patton tanks and the first fusillade that comes over goes through that. And we have guns well in advance of guns we had before, but we haven't gotten them into production yet, you see. That's the other trick. Because, you see, there are a few ambitious fellows who will manufacture adequate weapons, a few of them, you know, and leave them around where the Army can find them. And you get out into combat and you find that you need 200 new high-velocity anti-tank guns, and you have one. And it works pretty well until it's wiped out, but the dispatch that's sent back says, urgent, make some anti-tank guns. Then a bunch of manufacturers can waste a great deal of money building a bunch more anti-tank guns and getting them finished after the war is over. But they are ready for the next war. Here is agreement, you see. It makes an interestingly stupid sort of a view, doesn't it? I mean, the view is never a bright view when we are going forward on agreement instead of rational planning. Here is a reality. It is a reality because a number of us have agreed upon this reality. People who do not agree upon this reality is insane. Now, if you were to go to the Pentagon right now and say, boys, got a tip for you. We will never again fight the Korean War. And they'd say, that guy is nuts. He's nuts. If they had the authority, they'd probably send you over to St. Elizabeth's, being crazy. Because the agreement is that the weapons and tactics of the Korean War are the very thing to use when the major nations to be involved are thoroughly equipped with atomic weapons which require no infantry. That's why we're drafting everybody of age, see, because you don't need any infantry. We're still fighting the Napoleonic campaigns. That's where conscription came in. Everybody has agreed for so long that everybody ought to be drafted, you see. Everybody's agreed to such an enormous stretch of time that everybody's to be drafted. So on that, now that we don't need anybody in that bracket or category particularly, why, there we are. We're still drafting people. You're paying your income tax, I'm told, mainly to support the armed services, most of which is infantry and light ships and so forth. What are they going to do with it? Well, here again is an agreement riding past the time. Going on surviving. Well, that doesn't mean that all agreements have to be stupid, but it does mean that those people who are making agreements must recognize the reality of the agreement and the duration of the reality. And instead of just striking out for an utter forever, utterly blind to any necessity anywhere along the line to change, instead of striking out on that stupidity, if they strike out in the direction of, we have an agreement that we are going to progress toward certain goals, and these goals themselves can change when it is obvious by other matching realities that they should be changed, or that the modus operandi in reaching them should be changed. That's sense. That's looking at the reality which is opposing one and making a proper decision to overcome it or handle it. You see that? Now, that is an analytical function, and is the function of what we call in Dianetics the analytical mind. The other is a reactive function. We simply mock it up. Let's say that you were in your living room one day and a motorcycle came in the back door and hit you. And you say, ooh. And always thereafter, when sitting in your living room, always surround yourself with mattresses and cushions so as to catch any incoming motorcycle. That's the reactive mind, you see. Something happens, and it therefore sets up all the machinery and mechanisms to prevent it happening again. Or something good happens, and it sets up all the mechanism and machinery to make it go on happening again. It could be this way. You could find somebody who couldn't learn. He couldn't learn any modern dance, but he could certainly do the minuet. See, the reactive mind can minuet. Minuet was a good dance. What's the matter with a minuet? You know? Go on doing the minuet. You'll find people around that are still doing the Charleston. I dare say if you went around and tapped a bunch of people on the hip pocket with a nightstick, you'd also find a great many hip flasks. Just an overhang of prohibition, just a reactive action. Well, the fellow has, you know, you can't buy the stuff. You have to get it bootlegged. You got the idea? That'd be a reactive connotation. An inability to make a new agreement. A necessity of making every old agreement persist is the function and character of what we call a reactive mind. No thought goes along with it. It's just the tangle of experience as it goes along finally wells itself into some kind of a sloppy-looking piece of machinery. Maybe a government. Maybe a club. Something like this. It's some kind of sloppy machinery that somehow or other goes along some way. And you go up to the secretary or go up to the president's secretary or something and you say, oh, no. And the fellow says, what's the matter with it? And you say, well, after all, having horses tied outside here to carry dispatches down to Virginia, I mean, you actually send your dispatches by train and by airplane. And you got these Pony Express riders, and they're supposed to get them to San Francisco and so forth. What's the idea? Well, I says, what's wrong with it? Well, nothing. He said, you don't send messages by courier anymore. What's wrong with it? You say, what's wrong with you? And he said, well, now look here. He says, we've always done it this way. This is the way it ought to be done. You give me one good reason why we shouldn't have dispatch riders to ride down to General Washington's farm anytime we want. It's just that idiotic. Get the idea? So government goes along and you find some of the greatest oddities you ever looked at. At the beginning of World War II, officers were expected to have swords. And yet I think the last time a boarding sword was used was... Well, they didn't use one then. No. Maybe we used them then. Yeah. Yes, a boarding sword was used in 10,003 B.C. to cut a wedding cake. What do we have these swords for? Well, somebody says, and now we get to the real rub, it's custom. What's custom? Well, it's an agreement that nobody can do anything about. All right. Let's take a man. And this man is obviously a very complicated machine. He must be a complicated machine because he's very difficult to solve. But actually, the component parts of this machine are not complicated at all. The analytical function is one which analyzes the existing situation and reaches a conclusion in accordance with any optimum solution. The optimum solution is a specific and direct formula. It's the greatest good for the greatest number. And that's an optimum solution. So it just works on that basis, and it analyzes things, and it's willing to change any agreement that it can change. Down below the surface, what Freud called the unconscious, and others called the reconscious and preconscious, and gee whiz, and other complicated technical names. This, when we call, but we're not talking about the same thing, we talk about a reactive mind. They knew that down below the analytical mind, there was some kind of a mechanism, so that you got a happy idea, and you say, gee whiz, I got a new idea, there isn't any particular reason to be ill this week. And so I won't be sick all week. Ah! What makes him go that way? What made him cough? The analytical mind begins to wonder about it, too. It's irrational. It's not rational. No cold bugs. Nobody has been around. Nobody's been around with the cold. It's not the season of the year for colds. And so on and so on and so on. And there are no rationale connected with this, and yet the fellow's got a cold. What are we going to do about this? Well, formerly, it kind of just quit. Well, it's just that thing. It's just the innate cussedness of man. A fellow by the name of Plato wrote an essay on the subject of the wickedness of man. Actually, in this whole essay, he's doing nothing but swear at the reactive mind. He couldn't do anything about it. He had such a beautifully planned civilization. Everybody was going to go to school a certain length of time, and some people were going to work, and then you keep peeling them off by examinations, and finally when some of the guys got to be 80 years old, they were smart enough and old enough and experienced enough to rule in a group. He had it all figured out. You heard of his utopia. Well, this was a gorgeous scheme, and it just couldn't go into the works. Just not even vaguely would it go into the works. What was the matter with it? It was an analytical plan, which probably matched some reality in Plato's environment, if not in ours, and all of a sudden ran into this what? A set of set agreements which have been forgotten about, which are too deeply buried to easily change or alter. You understand that, see? So here you have an analytical function. Guy's very smart, very bright. He can see the situation. He can change it in all directions. And below that level is another mind which says, that's the way it is. Motorcycle comes into living room, mattress. It's the way we do it. That mind is quite as likely to be run over 5 times by an automobile in a row and find then that the pleasantest place to sit is the center of a street. Just as likely, because it's become a habit to be run over by automobiles and therefore is the thing to do. See? It's just however experience adds up. Well, what do all these agreements have to do with our goals? What does all this have to do with our goals? We could be intensely reactive, and we could say, our goals are so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so-and-so, and they will never change to the end of time. And then go on up the track, advance a few years, and all of a sudden realize that our wheels were skidding or were stuck or there was carbon in the cylinders. There's something wrong. We think back to how this could have gone wrong. Well, the HASI and the HDRF and their organizations would actually have a chance of doing something about it. We'd say, now look, we had these basic agreements and they're now haywire. Well, okay, let's, technical term, let's as-is them and let's make a new set of agreements. That would be the same thing to do, agreements which would match better the organization at hand. So any set of goals the organization has or might get would always, with this group, be subject to an alteration to a better reality. A better reality in the environment. Match up better with the environment. Square things around better. Shove the environment around. I'll give you an example of this. We all say, now the best possible goal we should have is to train a great many people in Dianetics and Scientology so they can do it expertly. That's the best goal. So that each one of these could go set up an office independently in an area and practice as a professional, much as a medical doctor or other people would practice. Now that sounds to be a fairly reasonable goal, doesn't it? Sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Maybe it was 5 years ago. Not even 5 years ago, it wasn't a reasonable goal. Why? We're dealing with a planet that is under the duress of something capable of changing its mode of life. The H-bomb. And if thee and me get so fixed on the idea that we're going to go to a nice, quiet city and we're going to set up a nice, quiet little office and we're going to have a nice, quiet practice, and as the years go by, we will all be accepted by the public. I always think that's a cute goal. And we're going to do this, and that's all we're going to do, and finally we will all be old and gray and very respected. Got it? All right, we all get this idea. We got it. It's a perfect agreement. It is set. It is woven into every action we are taking. See, everything we're doing, everything organizationally that's set up by us and so forth is headed just in that direction only. You see that? And all of a sudden, some slap-happy Russian crocked up on vodka puts his finger on a button and boom, no New Hampshire, Vermont, New England. Boom! No Oregon. Boom! No Wyoming. Boom, boom! We lost communication. We didn't even know what went then. And there are a bunch of people stumbling around, way out of communication, because all of a sudden they realize that they might get gamma-cated or something if they talk to somebody who has been reactivated. You don't dare touch food, you know, because it might be reactive. You don't dare shake hands with anybody. If you want to know what kind of a civil defense code this could finally add up into after we've been clobbered, look over the religion of the Brahmins. It probably came about right after an atomic bombing and was probably, this isn't an original thought with me, probably came along immediately after an atomic bombing as a civil defense code designed to preserve the greater number of the populace. You any idea what this religion's all about? Don't touch. You can't even eat in a restaurant. This is no lecture on that subject. I'm no expert on it. But it's kind of funny to see people as far out of contact as these people in a place so crowded. Now, all right, the radio stations go out and the buildings come down. You think, unless somebody discovers a better method of loading in cobalt-12 or something of the sort, you think man is going to be destroyed? Nah. He's tough. I did a little survey recently, and I might as well tell you about it. There have evidently been at least 5 atomic wipeouts of Earth. Where do we get this information? Archaeological information. Give you one of the sources. A recent archaeological expedition went over in the Near East. A very well-accredited expedition reported in the explorer's log and then reported. It got reported everywhere, as a matter of fact. Finally, it was reported in a science fiction magazine. But they dug up 7 levels out of a cave. They dug them up, and, you know, they find the time, you know, the pottery strata, and then the stone strata, and then so on and so on. 7 separate civilizations. They got clear down at the bottom of the cave, and they had green glass. Interesting. Several other evidences of this character, and not the least of them, are these very strange and peculiar civil defense codes which are woven into so many religions. Run for the hills, fellas. Do this, do that. Don't eat this kind of meat. Eat that kind, so forth. You read them now, if you read them, no matter their language, just as though you were reading a U.S. government civil defense poster immediately after the atom bombing, and you would say, gee, that's smart. That's just what we better do. That's good. That's real good. Get the idea. Here's a fixed reality. Man doesn't die easily. Every once in a while, I've been struck with this by watching man get into fires, floods, into some of the most unlikely situations. Remember one time, saw a freighter. Thing exploded. And cargo gone. Bridge was an entire mass of flames. What you could see of the ship itself, the paint was just bulging suddenly and bursting. Big bubbles would suddenly form on the side of a white-hot hull, you see, and break. Oh, that thing was a mess. There wasn't anything alive on that ship. Not a thing. There couldn't have been. Except the fellow, as we pulled in close to her, ran up to the bow and jumped down on our deck. How could he possibly have been alive? He was singed, yes, but he lived. Every once in a while, you'll see an automobile wreck. And the windows are all broken, and the fenders all crunched up, and the wheels turned this way, and so forth. And there'll be somebody sitting there smoking a cigarette. Boy, didn't I make a wreck out of that. One day, right out here at the racetrack, saw a couple of drivers lock wheels, something of the sort. Locked them so badly, I think one tire or one steering wheel went flying up to the air and hung itself on the top of a telegraph pole, some distance from the crash. One car went completely appetite over tin cup. Completely, end over end. Why, you said there's 2 drivers that are dead. One went to the hospital as a formality. The other one's all right. Here we look at man and we find that he is apparently a very weak, pitiful, little fellow. Then we start dragging him out of coal mines and wrecks And they're always survivors. Oh, yeah, you can rig up something so everybody's dead. But when you rig those up where everybody's dead, it's a good job, believe me. Thorough. Thorough. And it'll be in such a field that there are also other mines and shafts working at the same time with nobody dead in them. Got the idea? Man is a hard critter to kill. I imagine it would take him some little time under the present regime, which is evidently incapable of planning toward civil defense. By the way, I make that as a modified statement. This is public. I'm not swearing. Completely incapable of planning in the face of atomic bombing, and it is. This government planning, so-called, as pitifully inadequate as it is, as thorough as a bombing might be, a continent-wide A-bomb will still find men alive on this planet. They'll still find people alive in the United States. After New York City is bombed, slapped, crunched, and knocked silly, we went into the ruins, we'd start picking up a human being, and another one, 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 and another one. And how many do you suppose of that 7 million population would be salvaged out of that? Probably 50%. They couldn't have been salvaged out of it. The town was a raging inferno for hours and hours and hours. Radioactive, nothing to eat, no water, and they still lived. We had an example of this, the beach at Salerno. There was an Italian populace there. And this is where I pick up most of my data on the survival capabilities of man. There was a populace there. And it was shelled and bombed. It was fed everything that was indigestible that you could name. Wasn't fed gamma rays, but that would have just gilded it a little bit. And when the infantry had finally cleaned it up, the battle was over. There were still human beings around there alive, civilians. In all of the military government activities, it became very common. Here was a town which had been liberated. The coined phrase out of that, we sure liberated the hell out of that place. Flat. Couldn't have been anything alive in that town. Nothing. All of a sudden, here'd be its population to be cared for and to be fed. But they couldn't have survived such a debacle. Yet they did. All right. Supposing that we planned in the direction of this. And we said that's so inevitable that people are going to go absolutely pie, that they're going to use atomic bombs on man. Atomic bomb is not a weapon. A weapon, by definition, is something which you can use to protect yourself and attack somebody else. An atomic bomb can only attack somebody else and it can't protect yourself, you see. So let's go on this planet. Let's go on this planet solidly and we say everything's all going to be wiped out and torn up and let's all get ready and let's all get little tin hats or something of the sort and bad Scientology and fish these guys out of the engrams they'll get into this atomic bombing. Because believe me, they'll be nuts. They'll be crazy after this country's bombed. They really will be. With the communication lines all down, afraid to touch anything or anybody. Boy, if any country would need a little hand from a trained crew to straighten itself out, this country would at that time. So we say, well, let's plan in that direction. And then it never happens. Malenkov is replaced by Spalenkov, which is replaced by Bulenkov, which is replaced by Spulenkov. And finally, Siberia secedes. And finally, enough American salesmen get into Iron Curtain countries with enough gadgets to completely pacify the entire Russian nation. You can sell anybody enough radios, you'll pacify them. If you could only sell them enough television sets, you'd fix them completely. They'd never be able to think of going to war. They'd just sit there and look. So all right, that happens, you see. That's what occurs. And there we are in our little tin hats and our little badges, all set to save the world from an atom bomb. You want to know, by the way, what happened to technocracy? Technocracy was sitting around for years and years and years. Actually, a wonderful organization, a very brilliant man. But look at the goal of technocracy. Sooner or later, the United States economy was going to cave in. And it would be necessary at that time for trained men to step into that economy and run it. Now, it may be a poor statement of Scott's thoughts. Very brilliant. But it has in it the accidental clause. You understand? Accidental. Something is going to happen to the economy of the United States. Just what's the matter with the atom bomb planning? Something's going to happen with an atom bomb, and then we go to work, and we wait forever for the atom bomb. Well, I want to know in our planning why there is any reason we have to be so far out of communication with one another that we have to do reactive type agreeing. All of us are thinking beings. We see the problems at hand. We see what we can do when we can do it. We could have a number of plans to go into effect when this and that occurs. A number of them. And any one of them we could act upon in the event of such things as emergencies and so forth. But I'll make you a bet that we haven't got a plan for one of the worst emergencies we're liable to face. Met a couple of fellows one time. They were very happy fellows. I met them a couple of weeks later, and they were bitter enemies. Bitter enemies. They had planned everything concerning a gold mine, made all plans necessary for this gold mine, its discovery, its mapping, everything they were going to do with the gold mine. They were very, very happy, and then they found a gold mine. And that finished that friendship. Because they planned for everything but success. Everything. They were ready to go through thick and thin and go through all sorts of dramatics and privations except success. What were going to be their personal relationships in success? That's the most vital plan that we could make, and the one which we had better make. Whether we plan on an A-bomb, or a Q-bomb, or a stew-bomb, whether we plan on the AMA suddenly coming in on a special train with a white flag flying from its lantern on the locomotive, to deliver their corporation papers to us. No matter what kind of recognitions or accidents occur, there's one thing that we really ought to plan on. We ought to plan on success and what we do when confronted by it. Because this is the severest accident which can occur to us. Is a wide, nearly hysterical demand upon us, our time, and an effort on the part of the U.S. public or other publics across the world to stuff dollars in our pockets. That is an important factor. You know, when Alexander set out to conquer the world, he conquered everything but the prolixity of his troops to pick up baggage. He made them burn their baggage once, and then he got some himself. As soon as they started carrying much baggage around, they didn't do much world conquering. Well, we're not on any mission like Iskander of the Two Horns. We're not interested in conquering the world. or saving it either. It's been saved much too often. But we are interested in fulfilling our part of this society and civilization as best we can in view of the circumstances which exist. If we became tremendously successful to a point where we were the entire vested interest in the field of healing, and that is not unlikely, boy, could we go to pieces. What a bunch of bums we could be. You know? Long titles, suites of offices, hot and cold running stenographers. Huge parks and expanses, everything being maintained, everything going through according to regulations. Written way back there in 1955. Doesn't work. Not for a minute. We're the organization 3 feet back of the society's head. If you're going to be 3 feet back of society's head, then you sure as the devil better know how to change your considerations and act with a view of the environment. And if you look for set plans, then don't ever inspect an analytical mind. It doesn't operate on set plans. It operates on what has to be done, when it has to be done, to the best of its ability, for the greatest good of the greatest number of people. And that's the only plan on which I, and I think most of you, are operating, and I know that is a successful plan. Thank you.